It's The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and thanks so much for being here with us on the 4th of July. Today marks 243 years since the 13 colonies declared their independence. Our democracy and the ability to hold free and fair elections are a big part of what it means to be free in this country. But over the last few years, those elections have been, well, let's just say they've been tested.
Whew, what a night. 217 for Bush. 172 for Gore after Florida was moved back into the undecided column.
The Supreme Court overturned the Florida Supreme Court decision that allowed manual recounts of ballots.
Just moments ago, I spoke with George W. Bush and congratulated him on becoming the 43rd president of the United States.
This is the line to vote on Election Day.
Look at all the people. All these people.
So one of the scanners broke down. And then one of the next ones broke down, and then the next one broke down.
I waited in total about 2 hours and 12 minutes to vote.
The voter doesn't even need to leave the booth to hack the machine.
And how much does that cost?
$15.
So for $15, I could hack the vote.
From making it harder to register and stay on the rolls, to rejecting lawful ballots, we can no longer ignore these threats to democracy.
And then there was 2016.
Huge news, actually. The AP now projecting that Donald Trump has won the state of Pennsylvania.
That is the race, frankly.
They said this would never happen. He didn't stand a chance in the Electoral College that voters in swing states wouldn't vote for Donald Trump. And guess what? They were all of them wrong.
The indictment charges 12 Russian military officers by name for conspiring to interfere with the 2016 presidential election.
There were multiple systematic efforts to interfere in our election. And that allegation deserves the attention of every American.
Foreign interference in the 2016 election was a wake-up call for many Americans who may have taken the security of our election infrastructure for granted. And while there's been a significant effort to respond to that interference, cybersecurity journalist Kim Zetter says there's much more work to be done. When asked to grade our election system, Kim gives us a...
C to C minus.
So that's not a failing grade, but it's definitely not an A+. I spoke with Kim about the latest efforts to address election security and whether Robert Mueller's warning that our elections are still vulnerable is being taken as seriously as it should be.
There's still a long way to go. I think that we've made a lot of progress in terms of educating election officials and actually getting them to acknowledge that there's a problem. Many of them have willingly brought in the Department of Homeland Security to do some risk assessments of systems. But all of the focus right now has been on internet-facing systems, like the websites that are used to register voters, the back-end database for voter registration, and the websites for reporting results. What it hasn't focused on, however, are the actual voting machines themselves. No one has really looked at those, and we have decades of research showing that they are vulnerable to hacking.
And we've known that they're vulnerable to hacking. One of the things that came out of the Mueller report was our vulnerabilities. Why is it that we don't seem to be connecting the dots more strategically here?
Well, the federal government has had a real lag on election security because they've never been in charge of it. They've never been in charge of elections. They're locally managed. And so it's really been handed off to county election officials around the country who often don't have any kind of budget to hire even, let alone a security person, but even an IT person. And so they're often contracting out services, programming machines, taking care of the machines and things like that. And security has never been a priority for them, regardless of, you know, all of the 2 decades worth of researchers talking about how vulnerable the machines are. Local election officials have really kind of ignored that and pushed back against that for a long time. They've listened to the voting machine vendors who tell them over and over again, no, everything is okay, you're fine. And so there's been a real lag of the federal government stepping in and looking at this kind of issue. And now that we have DHS performing that role, I think we're starting to get a little more uniformity.
Mentioned the Mueller report, but I want to drill down a little more specifically here because I feel like it has fallen off of our radar a bit. There's one quote in particular that says, in November 2016, the GRU sent spear phishing emails to over 120 email accounts used by Florida county officials responsible for administering the 2016 U.S. election. And it goes on to say, quote, we understand the FBI believes that this operation enabled the GRU to gain access to the network of at least one Florida county government. What is happening in Florida's election system?
You know, that report came out in April, and very swiftly we learned that it wasn't actually just one county that apparently was compromised in the phishing attack, but two counties. And, I mean, let's look at that timeline. We are in 2019, and this happened in 2016. And none of that was made public for the longest time. You know, what the Mueller report has shown is that there is a real problem with disclosure, with sharing of information, critical information, and also conflicting information. Because as the Mueller report talks about a voting technology company that had malware installed on it, well, that seems to be pointing to a Florida company called VR Systems. And VR Systems has insisted that the FBI has never told them that they were successfully hacked. And so I think there are a lot of questions raised by the Mueller report that someone in government should be answering.
So one of the things that comes up here is the role of the FBI in investigating cyber crimes. What exactly does the FBI do compared to, for example, what DHS is doing?
So the FBI is doing criminal investigations. And so if you are a company that has been hacked, suspects that you've been hacked, what you will often do is you'll do one of two things. You will either contact the FBI first, or you will contact a private security firm to come in and do a forensic analysis of your network. The FBI will come in, and oftentimes they will simply take the report of the private forensic company and use that as their evidence. We saw that in the DNC hacking case, where a private company came in and looked at the servers and did an analysis. The FBI wasn't allowed to come in and look at the servers for obvious reasons. You know, victims are concerned about bringing the FBI and giving them free rein to sift through their network. So in this case, the FBI obtained the information from the private security company, obtained mirror images, and also were able to look at that themselves at that time. But sometimes the FBI doesn't do any forensic analysis. They rely on whatever assessment has been done by the private company. They will, however, do an investigation to trace back the attack to the perpetrators if they can.
We have an election, just a little election coming up in 2020, Kim, and I'm feeling worse about where we stand as voters right now in terms of our election security. Where does this leave voters? Is there enough time to even attempt to fix any of these problems, particularly in vulnerable states like Florida?
Yeah, so they've made progress in terms of taking voter registration databases offline or separating other systems from the internet. The, you know, DHS has given them a lot of a checklist of security practices that they should be following. But as I pointed out, many of these counties don't have money to hire a security person. So you can give them instructions and checklists, you know, one time, and you can do an assessment of their network. But security is an ongoing thing, and you can alter the security of your system with one move. And I'll give you an example. Oftentimes, you know, the election management systems, which are the systems that are used to program voting machines and also are used to tabulate votes after the end of the election. Election management systems are a critical component in the election infrastructure, and those machines should never be connected to the internet. So let's say you do have an air-gapped machine that isn't connected to the internet, but you have a worker who's sitting there on a machine that's not connected to the internet, and suddenly their mobile phone dies, and they want to charge it. And what do? They stick that USB cable connected to their phone into that air-gapped machine. You've now compromised that machine because that mobile phone is connected to the internet. And so election workers don't have that mindset of thinking through security in the way security professional is. And so regardless of all of the good efforts of trying to secure election offices, all of that can be done with one mistake.
We're talking about the issue of election security for Independence Day. And, you know, folks are probably going to be at the beach or enjoying a barbecue, but what do you think people need to know about the importance of our democracy at this point and the importance of free elections and fair elections right now as we head into this very important political season?
I think one thing that we still haven't resolved is what do we do when anomalies crop up in elections? We have problems that occur in every election, and usually when the election is over, no one wants to hear about it. We have now also, with the presidential campaigning being so long, the season being so long, by the time the presidential election occurs and it's over, people are tired and they want to move on. So we've had multiple elections where there have been problems that crop up in elections. Sometimes activists point them out. Sometimes some of the candidates point them out. And there's often a real offensive effort to prevent any kind of investigation. We saw in 2016 where people were calling for recounts. And there was a lot of pushback on that, and recounts were prevented. We saw that, of course, in the Al Gore Bush case in 2000, where there were problems in the election and people were trying to get to the bottom of it, and it went to the Supreme Court and cut that short. So we have something in this country that is really resistant to actually looking at problems that crop up in elections. And until we resolve that issue, you know, voters are sort of left in this situation over and over again of being asked to trust the results of election, but no one is giving them a reason to trust.
Kim, is that resistance political?
It's partly political, and it's also just partly the fatigue that voters have after the election. But, I mean, if you look at the case in 2000 with Al Gore, first of all, Al Gore was reluctant to push back on that because he knew what it would look like as the losing candidate. And then when he did push back, the results were, you know, what was anticipated. He was called a sore loser. And so what often happens is that the losing candidate is not the best one to bring up these problems because that becomes political. And so it's left to activists to really try and push for recounts and try and push for answers.
So I don't want to be cynical here, but I'm going to take a stab at it and say the losing candidate would rather not look bad than preserve our electoral integrity. I just want to make sure I'm understanding that correctly.
Yes, that is the situation that we have. And we really have to take it out of the hands of the candidate. If we really care about our elections and if we really care about the integrity of elections, we have to put this in law. We have to put these in statutes that when these anomalies occur, these are the steps that you need to take so that it's not put on the responsibility of the losing candidate to bring this up. It should be in statute that if this and this happens, these are the steps that need to be taken.
How confident are you in the upcoming election results into 2020 and beyond it, with given what we just talked about?
Well, that's a hard question to answer because I don't want to unduly worry voters. The point that I'm trying to make is that 2020 isn't the problem. This problem has existed with our elections for more than 20 years. If we're talking about just in terms of the time period in which electronic voting machines have been used, we have had elections with problems over and over and over again. So I don't want to, you know, focus on 2020 alone. That's not the issue. And the issue really isn't the Russians, really. The issue is that we have unsecure voting machines. We have had unsecure election practices for two decades. And we don't have the post-election practices that actually address that and can give voters confidence.
Kim Zetter is a cybersecurity journalist and author of Countdown to Zero Day, Stuxnet, and the launch of the world's first digital weapon. Kim, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Coming up, we're revisiting a series of conversations about how elections work in this country, where the gaps are, and what we can do to fix them. Stick with us. As we just heard, there are folks out there, journalists and cybersecurity experts, who say we aren't ready for 2020. But before we can figure out how to shore up our election infrastructure, every American needs to really understand how Election Day works. After all, how you vote depends on where you live.
There's actually about 10,000 little elections that are held on each election day rather than one big one.
That's David Becker, the executive director and founder of the Center for Election Innovation and Research. You might remember him from our show a few months back. And in this special hour, we're going to revisit a series of conversations we had around the last major election, the 2018 midterms, in order to better understand what it will take to make our voting system more secure for the next major election. David says the patchwork of systems governing elections is part of the problem, but it's also as old as the country itself.
And that really dates back to the founding of the Republic, where in the Constitution and in our traditions, it is typical that the states have control over elections. And within the states often delegate that responsibility down to the county or sometimes even the municipal level.
So we talked about this thing that I know people go, oh, gosh, infrastructure. But when we talk about election infrastructure, we're talking about a couple things, right? There are a list of names. There are accounting systems, there are reporting systems. Can you help us understand these different categories?
Sure. There are various administrative and technological processes that go into running elections, as you can imagine. And elections uses technology just like any other government or private sector area. And when we talk about elections infrastructure, we're talking about an entire ecosystem of technology that we need. I usually simplify it down to three basic areas. First, maintaining the voter lists themselves. In every state other than North Dakota, voter lists are maintained. And those voter records need to be maintained in a database and be accessible not just to the state election authorities, but also to the local election authorities so that they can update that information. And then that information needs to be transferred, sometimes in an electronic poll book, which can look like a laptop, that goes to the polling place to allow poll workers to check voters in on election day. So that's the first main area of technology that's used in elections. The second is all the technology that comes around casting and counting the ballots. So about 80% of people in the United States can cast ballots on paper. Those paper ballots are often fed into large tabulators that might look like large copy machines, for instance, that feed these documents in and read all of the ballot markings on them so that they can count them. Some people still vote on touchscreen machines, and there's technology inside of those that allows those ballots to be counted as well. So that's the second big area of technology. And then the last area of technology is once the polls close on election day, everyone pretty much expects election results to be delivered out immediately. And as a courtesy, election administrators try to get those results out, unofficial though they may be, as quickly as they can to voters and to the media. And that system, that election night results system, is another area of technology that's used in the entire elections process.
I'm talking about election infrastructure with David Becker, and that's basically everything from how you register to how you cast your ballot to how it gets counted. David, we hear a lot about the voter rolls, and you talked about maintenance of those lists. Who is in charge of maintaining these lists?
Well, the state usually takes responsibility, although the counties play a very large role in that. And one of the real challenges is, and I've done research in this for many, many years, is that Americans are highly mobile. They move between elections, and election officials don't get very good information on that. And I think most election officials would agree we want all of the eligible people to vote and be on the lists. But we also want to make sure that if someone has moved out of New York, for instance, or moved out of your state, that they can be easily removed from the list. And there are federal laws that govern that as well. So getting really good information on when someone has moved or when someone has died and making sure you get it right can be very, very challenging. And there are, as I said, federal laws that govern this. And there is additionally a tool that election officials can use in some states. New York doesn't, but 24 other states do. It's called the Electronic Registration Information Center, or ERIC for short, and I led the effort to create that. And it allows election officials to get much better information, much higher quality information on when a voter might have moved out of their state or within their state or died since the last election.
You know, I'm wondering also, David, why don't we have a system that, and I know we've heard about this, a lot of folks will talk about this, but why don't, isn't there a system where folks are automatically registered to vote when they turn 18?
So there are, what we lack in the United States and what many other countries have is some kind of official registry of citizens. We don't have one magic list in the United States where all citizens are on there with up-to-date information at any given point in time. So often the best database in a state of who might be eligible to vote is the motor vehicles database, but that's incomplete. Sometimes it's not up to date, but it is the best one. And many states have been moving towards taking the information that citizens provide them at motor vehicles and automatically transferring that information into the voter list. And that can be a very, very effective tool to not only get new voters onto the list, but even more importantly, keeping those that are already on the list with up-to-date information so election officials know how to contact them.
Yeah, in 2017, just before leaving office, the former Department of Homeland Security Secretary Johnson had designated this election infrastructure as critical infrastructure. And I'm wondering, if this infrastructure is so critical, why does it seem to be broken in some areas?
So I don't know that I'd say it's broken. I actually think that we're in better shape than we've ever been.
And why do you say that, David? Because I think then that's a competing narrative to often what we see in the news.
Well, there are a lot of folks in the news who are portraying a narrative that things are more vulnerable than ever and that nobody's doing anything about it. And I can tell you, having worked on this issue for a long time, There's been more work done to secure the election infrastructure in the last 2 years than we've ever seen before. And even though there are real threats from foreign adversaries, election officials are now sharing information better than ever before, not just between the states, but also down to the county level and all the way up to the federal government on potential threats. There are more tools in place to monitor potential interference in election offices than ever before. Nearly 90%, actually over 90% of all voters live in jurisdictions that now have highly sophisticated sensors monitoring activity coming in and out of the system. This was not where we were in 2016, and it reflects the tremendous improvements that have been made by election officials. It's not as sexy a story to talk about the hard work that election officials and DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, is doing to try to secure our systems, but it's the real story that voters should know that when they go to vote, that their votes are going to be counted as they cast them.
David Becker is the executive director and founder of the Center for Election Innovation and Research. David, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Hi, everybody. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. And we're broadcasting a special hour today all about our elections and what we can do to make them work better for the people. It's a big puzzle to solve. There are more than 10,000 election jurisdictions in this country. Within those jurisdictions are hundreds of thousands of polling places. And in a presidential election year, you need nearly a million poll workers to make sure things run smoothly. For a snapshot of just how different the voting experience is depending on where you live, we asked you, our listeners, and you weighed in from all across the country.
Greenbrier, Arkansas.
San Diego, California.
Kingston, New York.
Portland, Oregon.
Anacortes, Washington.
San Francisco.
Fort Worth, Texas.
Chester, Virginia.
Corvallis, Oregon.
For some of you, the voting process is a smooth one.
My name's Jeff Broido. I'm 72 years old, and I vote in Kingston, New York. I use a paper ballot, which is scanned and retained. Voting for me now is precisely the same as it was when I would accompany my parents as a child in the 50s to the voting booth.
My name is Ashley Smith from Greenbrier, Arkansas. I vote at my local community center. We have machines that give you a printout, which I then take over to someone. It's efficient and usually manned by some senior citizens from our community who volunteer. I have full faith in the volunteers running it and have never had an issue with the machine.
This is Rusty from Fort Worth, Texas. Places I vote are like a community center, and it's very safe and very convenient to vote.
This is Barbara from Chester, Virginia. My voting place is a local church. It's never a problem to get there. And I get the impression that the people who work there are extremely conscientious and security-minded. And even when the lines are really long, like a presidential election, they move very quickly. So I feel pretty good about it.
John Inger from Anacortes, Washington, and I vote with an absentee ballot. Therefore, my ballot has a paper traceable backup.
I'm Dee Dee from San Francisco, and I vote in San Francisco at a nearby high school. I love the sticker with "I voted" in four different languages that I get to put on my jacket. It represents the diversity of the voters in this city.
And our Takeaway listeners and voters in Oregon are pretty happy with the system they've got there.
This is Roman Gunther from Corvallis, Oregon. Oregon's vote-by-mail system is the best defense against election interference. Other states need to get on board.
I'm Lisa from Portland, Oregon. And in Oregon, we vote by mail. I love it. I sit with a cup of tea and the voter's pamphlet and my ballot. And when I'm done, I drop it in the mail or at a county drop box. And as far as I know, the system works very well.
And even when the process feels smooth, many of you express concerns about what happens after your vote is cast.
My name is Sue Joachim. I vote in San Diego County, and I choose to vote solely by mail. This way I know there's an irrefutable hard copy of my vote. My two horrifying concerns about the 2020 election are the imperative of voting Trump and his cronies out of office and the dread of how extensively Russia will have infiltrated America's elections. We seem to be sitting on our hands instead of installing new software, new equipment, and new processes to prevent their tampering.
I am really concerned about the influence of foreign governments on our electoral system.
I can't believe in 2019 people are still standing in line to vote. It just makes it difficult for people who can't stand that long, including having to manage little kids. I do have concerns about voting machines and cyber attacks. on the final results, not so much here in Washington, but certainly in other states.
There should be a universal system that can be monitored and kept secure. Why is this not top priority? All of these lawmakers love to brag about our system of democracy. Where is the funding to ensure that we actually are one?
That's the big question we're trying to answer this hour. What are the problems with this fundamental function of our democracy? And what can we do to fix it? Stick with us, because next we'll take a look at where the gaps in the system really are. And before the end of the hour, we'll explore some possible solutions to our election woes.
Hi, my name's Amy Walter, and I'm the host of Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway. These days in Washington, the news never stops. It's hard to keep up.
A big development in the Russia investigation.
That's your white working class voters coming out to vote.
But they didn't say anything about
the
investigation.
That's why each week we pick an issue, break down what it is, and why it matters to you. Join me each week on Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway.
With so many Americans casting their vote in different ways, there are bound to be gaps in the system. And that's where our next guests come in. Larry Norden is Deputy Director of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice. And Janae Nelson is Associate Director Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. And I spoke with them about the technological glitches, cybersecurity holes, and fundamental flaws in policy that make it harder for people to vote and the system less secure.
We are operating a system across this country that is completely out of step with the rest of the world, with other nations to which we compare ourselves. We are not enrolling people on the election rosters in automatic ways or direct enrollment, which is what we call it in some other places, where the moment you become 18 or on the verge of being 18 at the time of an election, you should be automatically registered to vote by the government. But instead, we have erected hurdles so that we have as many as 30% of eligible African Americans who are not registered to vote. And the numbers are comparable when it comes to Latinos, who are at a high of 42% of eligible folks in their communities who are not registered to vote. And if we think about the largest sector of the electorate, millennials, they too are woefully underrepresented on our registration rolls. And much of that is because of all of the barriers we've erected, including certain onerous identification requirements, including making it difficult to register. And there's so much more we could do if we really wanted to measure the climate through the voices of all the people in our country.
Larry, I want to turn to you back to the physical infrastructure. In 2016, you wrote a piece that talked about how the machines, the voting machines, are outdated and need to be upgraded. What about today? Where are we since then?
Well, we've made a little bit of progress, but the problem still remains, and I'd say it's a drastic problem. The Brennan Center did a survey of election officials. Officials in 33 states said they needed to replace their equipment before 2020. The vast majority of them did not have the funds to do so. And this isn't an abstract problem. In most cases, these machines are no longer manufactured. Too often, that means election officials, believe it or not, are turning to eBay to find replacement parts. So, as machines get older, obviously, you start seeing more problems. If you can't repair them, it means you have less machines in the polling places. That can lead to long lines. And frankly, there are security issues associated with using such old machines. If you're getting parts on eBay, that's a security issue as far as I'm concerned. You're using systems that are running on software that is no longer serviced by vendors, things like Windows XP, so you don't have security patches for them. And perhaps most disturbingly for those of us who work in the space, you still have 13 states that are using systems without any kind of paper backup. And that means if there's any kind of question about the results, there's no independent record to check the software with. And that's all of the experts say that's really not acceptable. The National Academy of Sciences just came out with a report saying these machines need to be replaced. The Department of Homeland Security has repeatedly said in the past couple of years, we should have systems that can be audited. And frankly, since 2016, we haven't made as much progress as I would like in replacing those systems.
But I just want to go back a second to the paper backup. Every time someone casts a vote, Can you audit those votes? Can you do an audit because there's no paper trail? Is that what you're saying? That because there isn't a paper trail, we can't audit votes?
Yeah. So for most people, what that means is filling out a ballot, a paper ballot, the way they would, you know, an exam or a lottery ticket. But in addition, there are machines that actually have what's called a paper trail. So they don't get the receipt that is held on by election officials, but they can see it and they can review it. And if there's a mistake, they can correct it. And that can be used later. It's not always, I have to say. This is another thing we have to work on and is part of the problem with having such a decentralized system. It really varies from county to county and state to state. But we can use that paper to say, okay, we're going to look at some of this paper and see if what the software is telling us is the actual result. If we don't have that paper, which we don't for 20% of voters, we basically have to trust that there was no error in the software, that nobody introduced malware or a virus or some kind of hack that changed the results.
Janae says the problems extend beyond infrastructure to a bigger question of why it's harder for some people to vote than it is for others.
There are concerns not only about how votes are cast and counted and whether there's any verification process, but also how people are able to have access to the polls and whether the equipment is equitably distributed, whether the opportunities to vote are equitably distributed. And what we're seeing across the country are numerous devices to keep the American public from the polls, and particularly minority communities. And they are becoming the largest portion of the electorate. And it's extraordinarily concerning that there are so many different ways in which we make voting difficult for eligible voters in this country, through mechanisms like early voting, through voter purges. So that creates a crisis of integrity because we have no faith that the individuals who vote are the ones who are eligible to vote. What we know is that this electorate is slowly being curated and handcrafted by election officials who can manipulate who gets on the voter registration rolls, and once they get there, who has an opportunity to cast a ballot in a fair and free and equal way.
I was just going to add another point that I think relates these issues, and it comes down to who is responsible for ensuring that there is integrity in our elections and that everybody who is a citizen of the United States and eligible to vote has the right to vote and can exercise that right.
And why doesn't the federal government take that role? I mean, I feel like if we're talking about something that has this many holes, that has disenfranchised people and is so critical to what this country is, i.e. a democracy, then why isn't this taken care of?
Well, I would say that it should be that there should be some minimum standards when it comes to both election system security and investing in our infrastructure and in making sure that citizens have the right to vote. But in fact, if anything, we've seen the opposite in recent years. You have the Supreme Court striking down critical sections of the Voting Rights Act, which has made it much easier for local jurisdictions to frankly manipulate the process and for partisans to decide who can vote and who can't vote. And you've got the same thing when it comes to the election infrastructure. Congress basically saying, you know, it's the state's responsibility, and the state's often saying it's the county responsibility. And what happens is you have vastly different standards, not only between states, but even within states.
Janae, I want to bring you in here because Larry was referencing Shelby, the Shelby decision. And I want to talk a little bit about how the Shelby decision lives, if you will, alongside these supposed improvements to the system that we're talking about that have happened since 2016. Janae, what are your thoughts on that?
Sure. The Shelby County decision was one of the most devastating decisions to undermine fairness and protections in our democracy. It happened in 2013 when the court struck down in a very contentious and split 5-4 decision, a provision of the Voting Rights Act that had protected minority voting rights for over 50 years. That provision decided that certain jurisdictions across the country that had a history of invidious discrimination would have to seek approval from the government, from the federal government, before they could enact a new voting change. And the purpose of that checkpoint was to ensure that any new voting change was not putting minority voters who had been historically discriminated against in a worse position. It was a protective measure to ensure that this country was not rolling back the clock and engaging in the discrimination that has characterized our voting system and our elections since its inception. Fortunately, a majority of the justices on the court thought that that way of targeting and requiring preclearance of certain jurisdictions was no longer necessary, that we had achieved enough protection and that there was no reason to believe that those particular areas of the country were in need of federal oversight. We vehemently disagreed, and the only point in which we can find any silver lining in Shelby County is that it has now opened the door for Congress to do even more. We believe that the type of preclearance that was required of a small number of jurisdictions is probably necessary for even more than were covered before, if not the entire country, because of the wave of voter suppression tactics that we've seen unleashed following the Shelby County decision.
Larry, I want to ask you about cybersecurity. We hear about this a lot. There's been all this talk about how vulnerable our systems can be to hacking, for example, to international interference or foreign interference. What are the vulnerabilities today, and are they different than they were in 2016?
I'm not sure that they're any different than they were in 2016. You know, the election infrastructure is vast, so there's a lot of focus often on voting machines themselves. But if you look at what was targeted in 2016, and frankly has been targeted in elections abroad in the past few years, it's things like the voter registration database, election websites, electronic poll books, which we use in 34 states, all these things that people use to figure out where they should be voting, and then election officials use to make sure that people are entitled to vote. And then there's there are voting machines, but then there's the election night reporting when we get results. And interference with any of these systems can create confusion, make it more difficult for people to vote, and often what the intention is, create doubt in the integrity of a system. I do want to say that we do, you know, because there's all this doom and gloom talk about these things, we do have procedures in place that should mean that even if there is some kind of cyber attack or interference or, frankly, mistake, right? No election is run perfectly ever, that people should still be able to vote and have their votes counted.
Larry Norden is the Deputy Director of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, and Janae Nelson is the Associate Director Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Okay, so all hour we've been talking about how our election infrastructure works in this country and all the ways it doesn't work, from the gaps in the system that leave people disenfranchised and to ways that systems are left vulnerable to attack. So how do we fix it?
The good thing is that most of the solutions to better our election infrastructure are practical.
That's Danielle Root, voting rights manager at the Center for American Progress. She says the first order of business for election officials is to get back to basics, and that means paper.
The first thing that states should do, if this is applicable to them, is if they are still using any kind of electronic paperless voting machines, so typically we call those DRE machines, they need to replace them with paper-based voting systems. You know, election security experts, computer scientists have all warned about the vulnerabilities of these paperless machines. And the reason is that, as you have probably explored in this show already, is that there's no reliable paper record of the voter's intent and how he or she chose to vote. And so we need those paperless electronic machines to be done away with and to be replaced with a paper-based system that can be relied upon then later on by election officials in post-election audits.
It's interesting we're talking about paper because it's one of the things we assume is sort of outdated, right? We do everything on our phones and everything everything else, but it's an interesting point that you make. What about auditing elections? We had a guest on that said, you know, we can do that to a certain extent, but we don't have a system in place to audit all votes. Is that right?
Right. So, you know, you think of after an election, after Election Day, there are millions and millions of votes cast. So it's really not feasible to audit every single vote. And it just, you don't need to either. You just need to be able to audit the precise number of votes necessary to confirm the outcome of an election. And the scope of an audit will depend on the margin of victory in a given contest. So if the margin of victory is quite large, election officials should only have to audit a smaller number of ballots, whereas if the margin of victory is small, election officials should be able to alter the scope of the audit to make sure that they're auditing more ballots to confirm the outcome of that tight election. But auditing really is necessary to protect our elections and ensure the integrity of our elections. And, you know, paper-based voting systems are incredibly important, but the overall impact of a paper-based system depends largely on election officials and states' ability and commitment to carrying out robust post-election audits that then look at those paper ballots, a small sample size, for example, to ensure that voters' intent and voters' choice are accurately represented in the outcome.
What about training when it comes to voter folks that work at the polls? How important is that?
Training for election officials and at the state and local level election officials is of utmost importance, particularly under the current threat environment, when we know that the vast majority of attacks and attempts at manipulating our elections are cyber-based. Our election officials at all levels work incredibly hard to protect our elections. And for the most part, they do a really, really excellent job. But most election officials are not trained cyber experts. And, you know, we can't really expect them to be. There's, you know, the cyber expert community is growing by the day in this country, but we need a lot of election officials. So we really need to begin training and intensively training election officials on how to recognize cyber attacks, including spear phishing attempts, and the proper way to respond to any fishy or suspicious activity that they see either on Election Day or when they are managing or overseeing the state's voter registration systems. So, you know, showing a video or, you know, having a conference for election officials once a year or twice a year is fine. It's a good starting point, but more certainly needs to be done. Colorado, for example, carried out what they called election war games, where it was really role-playing various election emergency scenarios, including cyber attacks that included election officials from all over the state, so that they were prepared and had actually practiced responding to some of these attacks. And that's the kind of intensive training that I hope becomes implemented nationwide for future elections.
And what about the federal government? I mean, I'm still surprised that we don't have a sort of federal voting system. But where can the federal government come in and help some of the states?
Excellent question as well. So DHS, who has sort of been managing the federal government's response to the Russian attacks in 2016, and DHS has a variety of services that it offers states to bolster their election infrastructure, including performing vulnerability assessments, which are free to states, by the way. There was, of course, a waiting list for states to receive that kind of assistance, which was unfortunate. But as far as I know, DHS has now sort of caught up and is performing those assessments at a speedier rate, which is great. But in addition to supplying sort of advanced cybersecurity security measures and tests for state election infrastructure, the federal government plays a significant role in information sharing with state and local officials. Federal officials, particularly national security experts, are privy to some of the more classified or higher level threats to our elections that state officials and local election officials are not privy to and are not receiving talking points on, but also readouts of who our adversaries are and what they're trying to do to infiltrate our elections. So there needs to be a direct line of communication between the federal government, what they're hearing, what they know, and the state and local officials who are working to protect our elections on a daily basis. And there have been efforts since 2016 to better that communication line. For example, DHS and EAC, the Election Assistance Administration, have held conferences with state and local officials to sort of talk about these issues, how they're going to better the information sharing system. But there's always room for improvement. There are still states and local officials who say that they, you know, are unaware of what's really happening in their locations, in their jurisdictions. So information sharing still needs some improvement between the federal government and state and locals. But I do think there has been improvements since 2016. So that's always good.
Danielle Root is with the Center for American Progress. Danielle, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And that's our show for today. But if you have concerns about whether or not your vote will count come primary season, here's one final tip from Larry Norden at the Brennan Center for Justice.
There is an election protection hotline. The phone number is 866-OUR-VOTE. And there are experts there that can help and that can make sure that you get to cast that ballot.
Thanks for spending your 4th of July with The Takeaway. Remember, you can always find us on Facebook and leave a comment there and follow us on Instagram for some behind-the-scenes action. We may not be an election hotline, but you can always call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. And if you miss anything or want to listen back again, check out our podcast. Happy 4th of July. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Noom, offering a personalized weight loss program that uses psychology and small goals to change habits with the goal of losing weight and keeping it off for good. Learn more at Noom, Noom.com.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.